Well, that was awesome. I'm very satisfied. I will turn it over to you, Sina, to continue the grilling of our guest here.
Now I'm rolling up my sleeves. The bad cop has arrived.
Poor Manani's got a blood sugar. Do you want to go get a coffee or something, man? Like, jeez.
I have a coffee.
Anyways, this was that was a fun transition. That was very fun. No seams detected. None at all. So this is something that I wanted to get back to. I kind of previewed it with my earlier question because I couldn't wait. But there's a line on 204. So the idea of Hindustan as a polity had already become a dim memory by the time the sepoys had risen up against their colonizing officers in 1857. The literal killing of the future heirs to the Mughal throne enacted a grim foreclosure of any possible future for it. The period after 1857 is labeled, quote, direct rule, or, quote, the Raj, by scholars. Queen Victoria took on the title of, quote, Empress of India. The British East India Company was discarded, and the role of managing and civilizing the subcontinent was taken up by the British Parliament. It is certainly appropriate to recognize the systems of rendition and amassment that ended the idea of Hindustan and established, quote, British India, but it is essential to underscore that the British conquest of Hindustan was done by shedding Hindustani blood. Right, so this is the convergence, at least in some ways, that there is a convergence of imperial projects, at least that happens in 1857, or at least there could be a kind of maturation. At least this is my very uninformed theoretical reading, is that in 1857, the formal management of the British sort of colony of India transforms into this hyphenated project, right? Like the Anglo-Indian takes over. You know, one of the jokes in Victorian sort of 19th century studies is that all Victorian plots end in one or two solutions, marriage or emigration, right? And like, sometimes I'm watching something and like, I know that the person, I know the book, and I know that one of the plots is that the stupid fail son gets shipped off to India.
Right.
And it's like a joke, right? In the kind of narrative for the author who's writing this from London or wherever, it's like, haha, send jerkass to India, let them deal with him, right? But like before, that used to be a kind of like narrative trick. I used to be like, haha, I'm so smart, I know how this works. But now I want to reach into whatever I'm reading and strangle the person who's about to go to India. And I want to say, like, stop sending your garbage to like a nice place.
Right.
Because that's what you start to realize, that like so much of the kind of, I don't know how to put this, but like, so much of what we know, at least what I know, someone who's like an outsider to all this stuff, of this massive subcontinent comes through just through like little kaleidoscope flashes of British India and guys like Kipling and the response to him. And this thing about how they killed everything to enact their idea, and their idea was this dream subject. So we haven't talked about Macaulay and the idea of creating this class, given how much, and this is my question part, I'm done with my rant, given how much like the institutionalization of post-colonial studies, like, is this, can we now start to think past British India? Is there a way forward to break out of the sort of colonial mind frames that so many of us, again, I may be projecting, though, because someone like me sort of live under, again, totally broad, not question, but I don't know. I just have all these thoughts that are a jumble. I'll let you talk now.
Thank you. So I think there's one part of this that is predicated on our, what I call in the book, our access, you know, the quote that was read out earlier, that colonialism renders the indigenous access to the past and blurs their faces and names. I think this is that one part, first of all, which is that the capacity for the post-colonial scholar who is not conversant or reading Persian, is not conversant or reading Braj, is not conversant or reading in any of the kind of, obviously Tamil in many respects continues its literary tradition across the colonial divide. But much of this past renderings, past work that are pre-colonial enter the post-colonial scholarship through Oriental translations, right? And are not ever questioned. They're just simply that the Orientalists translated Mahabharata, the Orientalists translated Ramayana, the Orientalists translated Shadi's Gulistan. And, you know, we can kind of read these. We can read Akbarnama in translation. We can read Farishta in translation. We can just read these Oriental translations even if we condemn the Orientalists themselves, we can read their translations and enact a theory of post-coloniality on the backs of those renderings. And that's something that I feel is untenable. It's something that is impossible to do. And there's no question in my mind that there's some fealty to the text that the Orientalist brings that somehow renders their efforts non-colonial to me, or renders their critical edition useful knowledge for me as a post-colonist subject. And I think what happens in post-colonial studies by kind of drawing the line at or around 1857 is that all of the texts that are in Persian or in Braj or in Dakini or belong to the Muslim, quote unquote, under the colonial episteme, belong to the Muslim world, are out of sync, out of touch, out of reach, I guess. Out of reach is the right word. And so much of the post-colonial scholarship then is engaging, if it's engaging with the pre-colonial in any form, it's only through, let's say, you know, Kipling's understanding of the pre-colonial Muslim, rather than the scholar themselves reading something. Obversely, people who do the training and who do read these archives of pre-colonial textual worlds refuse to engage in what we could call post-colonial studies. So they say, okay, I'm studying, you know, the 15th century and I'm studying the 14th century. And what I'm doing is pre-colonial. And so hence has, you know, why would I do anything called post-colonial studies or subaltern studies or anything? Because my object of analysis lives in a world before colonialism. Now, the world that they imagine their object lives in is actually in the British Library. It's actually in, you know, Staatsbibliothek in Berlin. It's actually in McGill. It's actually at Harvard. And those texts, those objects that they're studying in the Met or they're studying in the Pergamon did not get there, you know, through some act of diplomatic exchange. It got there through conquest, and they got there through dismemberment and violence and projects of amassment. So I
like they stole the memory of the world.
Exactly.
Like how do you even articulate what kind of crimes that's involved? Like, yeah, like Killmonger was right.
No, and they did a lot of like physical destruction of those archives and memories, right?
Well, I mean, you go to the Met right now. If you go to the Met and you go to these quote unquote Islamic galleries, you will see the so-called miniatures, which have been ripped from their context, their books, the part of the manuscripts they were in, and put behind glass. So we can look at the pretty pictures, right? So that's violent right there, as in the illumination or the illustration is literally been cut out and sold as standalone. And so, I mean, so I think that's where I think there's I feel like there's two strands that have happened, and some of the ways in which my work refuses a periodization of colonial pre and post colony. Is precisely that I want to push back against this idea that the post-colonial scholar can say something without, you know, speaking solely through the language of the colonizers, speaking solely through French or solely through through English. And that it's not a nativist claim, I don't feel, at least. I do feel that it's a claim that renders the transparency of translation and makes that transparency a problem. And I think to this day in Pakistan, I can walk into a popular bookstore, non-academic. I mean, there is no academic bookstore, but I can walk into a popular bookstore and I can see, I can find current reprints of colonial gazetteers, current reprints of translations from early 19th or mid 19th century that are in, under new cover and just sold as that text. So you have a world, a post-colony, in which the, you know, if you want to read something that was written in Persian or written in Braj or written in Sanskrit or written in any language that is no longer taught or part of the administrative cultural language, you only can access it through these colonial translations, which are then considered to be, you know, invisible. That act of translation is considered to be invisible. And so that's why in my work, I tried to kind of highlight how these renderings actually are so intimately part of the colonial violent project. And I call them, instead of Orientalists, I call them soldier scribes, in order to both denigrate the so-called excellence of their work, but also to highlight their capacity as military subjects who are literally shooting someone in the face in the morning before sitting down for 2 hours of quote-unquote translation work in the early evening while a poor Indian subject waits on their feet.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's blood boiling. And this business of like, and it's partially too, there's an issue here of the sort of tyranny of Britishness that rules over the kind of, let's say, sort of post-Anglo world. So like in Canada, it's rendered as, you know, the genteel British Isles. They're so special. People genuinely have more knowledge about like Scotland and Ireland here than they do about vast swaths of the world, which are tiny, right? Like, which tells you that like the settler colonial project of fetishizing, you know, the source, if you want, right? Like, is still very much going on. Like, to bring back my other example, like you know, we had to suffer through that horrible funeral. We have to suffer through, like, my God, they're making a whole drama soap opera, like some ethical soap opera, out of their stupid fight between their newest acquisition, Meghan Markle. Like this is the absurd world that we live in, where instead of talking about like the actual things that this little island did to terrorize the world and like all of the like after effects that are still lived out daily by billions of people, like potentially, like that. Instead of talking about that, we get this cartoonish, you know, corny, like it reminds me of like Arrested Development and like Little Britain. Like that's all that's left of Britain, is just like an idea of itself. You know, it doesn't have its empire. We all know that it's just like a kind of, it's like the old pedo uncle of the Americans now that just sits on its shoulder.
It still has the Cayman Islands and some other weird criminal enterprises that it owns, right?
But like, Jersey. Look at the Suez Crisis. They tried to flex their muscles in a way that they did for centuries. They tried to just like, oh, this little brown guy wants to stand up to us? Watch. Look at what happened to them. They got smacked down by their nephew. Like, that's the weird thing of like, we've lived in a like, in a world that like, that the British Empire has been declawed. This joke, like Boris Johnson is the perfect encapsulation of what their empire was and is. Like just this cartoonish. I mean, we had Tony Blair, who in his own ghoul way, like soulless way, he was his own vicious creature, just what he did to Iraq alone. But like, I just can't help but think that like the concept of Britishness itself is still an immense tool that they have in their arsenal, cultural tool that like that they can still dish out, and like the relationship between, say, the formerly colonized and Britishness is still this thing that happens. So, for instance, one of the questions of your book is how there's this persistent idea, again, something that I fell for, but something that I considered to be just fait accompli, like. This business of, oh, England, like the British Empire, stitched together this country for the first time and gave us, so whether you like it or not, it created this country for you, right? Like, that's one of the like rare, like persistent sort of pernicious myths that, again, that you sort of outline and is kind of one of the main targets for your book. But like, to me, that it's actually the opposite, that one of the weapons that they have is this thing called Britishness and how it can still be deployed and how we still live under, you know, whatever, just like this little island that did immense damage to the world, whose life we now exist in the aftermath of, that we have to. And there's another thing here. Me, I'm an Iranian guy. Like we have another relationship of we don't really have a relationship of colonization per se to the British Empire. And we're like next door neighbors. Like that's how radical this is. Consider what the British Empire did to India, and consider what it did to ancient Persia or Persia, whatever, like Iran, Persia. Like those are vastly different colonial experiences that unfolded for different reasons and whatever. Like, I don't know the historical actual reasons, but like that itself has left an effect on Iranians to this day, whereby BBC Persian, which is this, you know, obviously propaganda rag that's obviously dedicated itself to part of like a whole, like, you know, the soldier of regime change, you know, like this is still something that has a powerful effect on Iranians. Like the news, the bullshit BBC news is something that liberal Iranians will take in, you know, every day of their lives. And I'm sure this is also true about South Asia too, that there is the kind of liberal class of cultivated, educated types who look to the West and sort of, you know, this is still something that is the Persian word. But anyways, that wasn't even a question. I'm not even going to pretend that was a question. I just have thoughts. You know,
I mean, I think it's something that is part of kind of decolonization, part of that struggle of decolonization has been, how do we recontextualize colonial rule and colonial dominance as previously colonized peoples? And language plays an incredibly important role, as you know, we all know that, you know, how do we kind of still continue to speak French or still continue to speak English or and still be able to render the violence of French or British or Dutch or German colonialism be clearly both. And I think for the academy, and especially for the historians, or even for literary scholars, I think the burden is perhaps even greater, because you can have a language of politics that can say it will be conducted in Hindi or in Farsi. And you can say, you know, as Iran does, like, you know, we have our own calendar, as India does, that we have another calendar. So we are out of kind of, you know, the temporal regime of the colony. We're out of the link politically, we're out of the, in our political speech, we're out of the linguistic regime of the colony. But what happens to the social sciences? What happens to the humanities? What happens to natural and even physical sciences, where the role of the intellectual is actually unimaginable, is invisible outside of those colonial registers? You can be an intellectual writing primarily in a non-colonial language and wait your entire life and perhaps a generation or two after your death to be made legible in the colonial language through a translation. You could be the shittiest French quote-unquote philosopher, and your third-rate, you know, musings will be published within a year or 2 years of you publishing it in French, by a very reputable academic press or a popular press in America or in the UK. So that idea that we can be intellectuals in a non-colonial language and be read, be understood, be heard, be part of syllabi is actually the real kind of pressure point that, as far as I can see, in thinking about decolonialism. And so one of the things that I think I looked at these historians who are writing in the late part of the 19th century under colonialism, you know, as you mentioned, this moment in 1857, post-1857, who are saying, like, how do we write against this idea of British Raj? How do we write against this idea of British colonialism? And these are people who are also sympathetic to the colonial project, as in they see a lot of good in it. So they're not simply anti-colonial. They have, you know, various kinds of, you know, relationships to them. And when I read these figures who are writing in the 1880s to 1920s, 1930s, you know, one of the things I discovered was that I asked myself, why was I never taught them in any of my seminars, in any of my historiography seminars, in any of my, and one of the reasons was that they weren't writing in English. And because they were not writing in English, their intellectual output was invisible. And because their intellectual output was invisible, it became, it was not part of any story of anti-colonial or nationalist or even historiographics that we can tell. And if I take that moment of the 1890s, 1920s onward to now, and I ask myself, you know, what is the thought that is in Marathi or that is in Urdu or that is in Farsi, that is intellectual thought of importance that I need to be reading in order to kind of think about what, how to think of this world, whether in purely humanistic ways or through, you know, any kind of analytical way. I am, as a reader, I'm dependent on this infrastructure of the academy, infrastructure of publishing, infrastructure of translation, that is completely and fully colonial in its worldview, and only can see particular languages, particular subjects, particular objects visible. And I think that struggle is something that I feel, again, it may be theorized under the category of quote unquote world literature, but that's again not something that's visible in my field of history, where we literally never, ever, ever talk about it. We've never talked about, you know, a figure, a historian, or someone writing history in a non-European language that is part of our everyday conversation, like figures like Gadamer or, you know, de Certeau or any of the others, people who write in European languages that get, you know, translated into English and become part of our historiographic and analytical conversations.
So what do you hope then? Like, what is your hope for what you can do with a book like this and, like, you know, over however many, you probably have a couple of decades left of your career, you know? What do you hope to accomplish in such a neo-colonial intellectual context?
I mean, I'm
asking for a friend.
I'm not only in a neo-colonial context. I mean, I get my paycheck from here, my friend.
I know. You know, I feel you.
this is a very polite struggle against the breadcrumbs. No, I think. From what I see, and again, let me be very specific that I'm speaking of the history profession, I guess, in the American Academy in 2020s, et cetera. I think what I see is that the post-colonial turn, if it hit history departments, it hit very marginally, and it's over. You know, you don't see historians thinking from a post-colonial perspective. You don't see historians even deploying. You know, we have a new wave of great intellectual work that's coming out that's under kind of the flag, let's just say, of decolonization. But it's not. It doesn't cohere that much as a field at the moment. My, I guess, effort in this particular book was to make two claims. One, that Europe's story of itself is incomplete without the violence that it does in a geography like Hindustan. And I wanted that violence, both in terms of its archive that it creates and this world that it erases, to be more clear. And the second part of, I guess, my intellectual agenda is then to perhaps take this capital H history or capital M memory, ways in which we can think historically, ways in which we think about the past, and try to unmoor them from an infrastructure that, for all the love I have for these intellectuals, that actually it rests in Hegelian dialectic or rests in the critique of materialist of you know, of historical materialism by folks like Walter Benjamin, etc. And so to me, it's like, what is a way, an intellectual pathway for thinking about the past as a post-colonized historian, as someone who is, you know, is invested in a project of decolonization of the field of history. How do I write from that perspective? How do I build another infrastructure, possible infrastructure? There have been many, many scholars who have been invested in that project, and I'm hoping to draw on them. I draw on them. One of the ways is, of course, like, you know, the people you cite, the language that you think through, and of course the people you speak to. But one of the ways that I want to do this in my next book, which I'm thinking through right now, is to go back to that observation I mentioned earlier, which was that why was history as a discipline so important to anti-colonial thinkers? What is it about history as a discipline that both is the most important, I want to say, tool of colonization, right? It's the way in which the colonizer strips the power, the agent of power out of the colonies through history writing that the colonizer does. And simultaneously, it's the space of resistance. It's the space of reclamation. It's the space through which we, as colonizers, colonized, have been able to speak through. And why, when we think through indigenous histories in the present, why we think through spaces like, you know, Palestine or Kashmir, why the weight of history, both that which is visible and accessible and that which is invisible and inaccessible, becomes so great for us, you know, and why we think about like modes of storytelling that can compensate or overwhelm the colonial historiographic project. So that's basic kind of a vision that I want to hold on to as part of my intellectual project, I guess.
So we've kept you for over an hour, almost an hour and a half. We will liberate you soon, I promise. But one final question, at least for me. I want to ask basically the same question, but from the other angle, is that I would say that what the decolonizing sort of project, from the perspective of somebody who supports it or wants to engage in it, from, let's say, like the booster of it, right? The mercenary of decolonization, if you will. Like, that's easy. That's clear, right? Like, attack empire, right? Like, attack its vestige. I mean, maybe not. Like, it's not unclear, but whatever. It's straightforward. But then another thing is that, like, we're running up against their provincialism, right? Like, we have this wall of provincialism that we have to break through on their end, which is that, like, the world is small for, you know, the average history student, average history professor, for God's sakes. You know what I mean? Like, the world is, like, if you looked at most academic departments and their specializations, the world is a small place,
yeah.
Right? Like it's like the map, like that famous map of the world, right? Where Africa was squished down because that's how they see it. It's not important, right? And so, like, I guess my final question would be, like, how do you face down their very militant provincialism and their refusal to open themselves up to different perspectives? And I don't mean to personalize it. Like, there are, you know, and this is a pan-racial project, colonization. There are lots of closed-minded brown, black, non-white people who don't see the world, who see as little as the world as, you know, your Neil Ferguson or whatever, right? Yeah. Like, this is the liberal project, the liberal imperialist fiction of the world as be like that like, you know, those history scholars that you talked about at the beginning, the philosophy of history, those guys cooked up. I mean, Hegel saw America, like, Hegel was like the first neocon. If you read his history, the lecture, the lectures on world history.
Yeah.
Like, the guy was a neocon. He thought America was the end.
Right.
Like, that's essentially what he said. Like, America is the end of Geist. So, like, they, you know, this is like the deep seated ignorance of the world and their lack of worldliness, I find to be the biggest issue that I have these days in, you know, in whatever, right? Like, I to talk about decolonization, like, this podcast has been one of the ways that I sort of decolonized myself, Like, I got everybody involved in helping Sina. Like, it takes a bridge or it takes a village to help decolonize Sina's brain. So I've spent the last almost 3 years talking to smart people and, like, decolonizing myself slowly and kind of deprogramming myself of, like, basic things. And so, like, this process for me has been totally liberatory. But, like, it's more that, like, the vast well of ignorance that we have to confront, right? Like, that's been institutionalized over centuries, whereby, you know, like, parts of the world are ascribed, like, a meaningless significance. And on top of that, in the administrative sense of the university, just make a little corner of the university for them and they can do their little native dances, right? Because that's what they did with post-colonial studies. They said, oh, very interesting, very interesting. So you guys want to take this place over here. Here's a corner of it. Go away now and leave the rest of us alone, which is kind of what happened. People kind of took the and just made it themselves, which you understand. Like, people, generations do that. But go ahead. Sorry.
No. That's literally what happened. And, you know, and it's never going to happen again. I don't think that we're in a world where we will be told by an administration, here's a plot. Let's call this plot decolonization, and you build your little tent on this plot. I don't think it's going to happen again. The lesson learned from the post-colonial plot giving was that we don't want to repeat that anymore. I find myself going more and more towards, I guess, what this podcast represents, community pedagogy. I find myself going more and more towards building alliances with listeners and thinkers who are not in the departments of history, but are in other forms of both thinking and creative and analytical, thought making. I find myself not only speaking to these individuals, thinking through them through podcasts or YouTube videos, lectures or Zoom lectures more recently, but also find myself writing towards that goal. And I don't see it as a retreat from the institutional. I see it as part of that third world imaginary that actually created some of these just insane stories that we know from the turn of the 20th century. Of revolutionaries traveling from space to space, organizing, thinking together, building communes, building resistance, getting noted by the colonial authorities, getting put into prisons, assassinated, quarantined, et cetera, et cetera. We've tended to kind of romanticize these figures, Ram Mohan Roy, for example, or others. But romanticism in the sense, again, of German idealism, like it's the past. And I think we ought to pay a little bit more attention to the mechanics of that thought, to how these intellectuals and activists and theorists were able to connect with each other, and what was the futurity that they were able to speak to, on what grounds of that futurity. I saw myself in Ferguson's uprising, teaching a class here on Columbia campus, thinking about what was happening in Ferguson. And thinking about how there was I remember very clearly there was a Palestinian flag that was flying next to the Black Lives Matter flag. And I remember saying to myself that, you know, there is futurity possible. There are alliances possible. We can actually fight for justice, and not in the divided spaces that recognition is given to us by the colonizer, but in concepts like Hindustan, in concepts like Black Lives Matter, that escape that fate that colonizers subjected. And I find great hope and I find great power in that. And now, would I be able to change my history department that I'm a part of? I really doubt it, and I really am not in that struggle. I'm not here to create a 10-year line or a course on the books that can make some little part of the academy, you know, more palpable. I want to make sure that the conversations that we are having escape this very, very narrow way of thinking about the world that the academy has painted itself into. deliberately, I must say. And I guess so that's in, when I think about decolonization, I think of it not simply about the institution that in which I'm a part of or I primarily belong to in my capacity as an earner, as a wage earner. But I think of decolonization as really a conversation that is larger than me, that connects me to the native struggle in the United States, the struggle for rights in Palestine and Kashmir and Balochistan, that connects me to intellectual thought that is for dignity and for access to history. And how can my story, how can the story that I have help think through those other stories? I think that's really the spirit with which I'm trying to approach the future.
And that is the spirit with which we're really happy to have you on, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Manon. That was really amazing.
Thank you.
Manon Ahmed, the loss of Hindustan, the invention of India.
And he also has the best Twitter handle in the world, the Twitter username.
Was well done. You know, speaking of like putting your pin in the digital space, that was well done. Well done. Sepoy.
It's Sepoy. Sepoy. At Sepoy. Find him. Follow him. He's the king.
Thank you. Thank you, my friends. Thank you for having me. Thank you for giving me some space on your wonderful worlds that you've built with your labor of love and intellectual work. So I really appreciate this.
Oh, shucks. That was very nice.